Welcome to Evening Under Lamplight, the show that invites you to attend. I am Robert Louis Abrahamson, and we are coming to you on Cambridge 105, Community Radio in Cambridge. Our home on the web is momentsunderlamplight.com, where you can find literally scores of podcasts of earlier shows, and where you can get in touch and comment about the shows. But as I announced on the last show, tonight's Evening Under Lamplight will be the final show in the second series of our programmes, a series that began on 25th July 2010, and we've had 47 episodes for this series. But it's time to let go, time to move on. The archives will still be there, of course, and we'll look forward to Series 3 coming along sometime in the future. Keep in touch with me and with Moments Under Lamplight on Facebook, where I'll be sure to announce when short, non-radio podcasts have been posted. I said last time that we'd do a Christmas special for this December show, but you know us. We never do the straightforward conventional thing. The theme this evening, Under Lamplight, connects us to the myth of Christmas, that celebration of the light of men that shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. That is to say, a celebration here in the darkest time of the year of the light still there for us, a light that the darkness cannot comprehend or take over or extinguish. So a kind of double theme. First, the darkness, the long night both outside us and inside us, and then the light, also both outside us and, more importantly, inside us. Or to put it another way, here we sit at evening tide, under whatever lamplight is shining out for us. Let our show this evening, Under Lamplight, be a point of brightness for whatever darkness may be around us. We are, of course, in the time of the solstice, which is traditionally celebrated by bringing light inside, by gathering around the hearth, the focal point of the home in days before electronic screens, or by lighting special candles in a defiance of the darkness, or in a solemn faith that this darkness too shall pass. There is light outside too, in the starlight. Oddly enough, this solstice time does not seem to speak much of the light of the moon. Is the moon more appropriate for other seasons instead? The starlight is an interesting image. Those remote points of light, not really bright enough to illuminate our darkness, but describing patterns in the heavens that people have been interpreting for ages. It's a kind of mental illumination, a source of meaning and direction, too, as we follow whatever star seems to be guiding us. And speaking of mysterious starlight, let's start off with a little quatrain I came across recently from the Scottish Poetry Library, an adaptation of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, turned into Scots by Lorna Irvine. You won't catch all the words, but surely enough to follow the lines and enjoy the flavour of the poem. Skimmer, skimmer, doosie star, it fairlies me, fair what ye are. Heech aboon the world sae bricht, losin' like up in the lift.
Yeah.
That was Twinkle Twinkle Little Star by Steel Iceman, accompanied by some wee innocents. And you may have noticed that one of the singers couldn't help singing instead of Like a Diamond in the Sky, Like a Tea Tray in the Sky, as all of us who know our Lewis Carroll are always tempted to do ourselves. Well, next we have a little daftness from the old philosopher. Some people's response to the darkness in life is just to laugh at the problems. Treat the darkness lightly. It's absurd that life should be so horrible, so why not take that absurdity even further? Just follow the advice of Eddie Lawrence, coming to us as the old philosopher, in a piece we've heard before on Evening Under Lamplight, but need to hear again every so often, just to keep us moving, even just moving in our seats. Hiya, folks. Let's begin.
Hiya, folks. You say you lost your job today. You say it's 4 a.m. and your kids ain't come home from school yet. You say your wife went out for a corned beef sandwich last week and the corned beef sandwich came back, but she didn't. You say your furniture's out all over the sidewalk because you can't pay the rent and you got chapped lips and paper cuts and your feet's all swollen up and blistered from pounding the pavement looking for work. Is that what's troubling you, fella?
Lift your head up high and take a walk in the sun with a dignity and stick to it, and you show the world, you show the world to get off. You never give up, never give up, never give up that ship.
Hey there, friend. You say your radiators didn't work all winter, and now that it's summer, they started up again and you can't turn them off. Say your wife sent your lightweight suits to the cleaners, and that means you'll have to wear your itchy tweeds this morning when they say it'll hit 106. And you gotta meet an important businessman in an hour. And your bridge just broke, and you pasted it together with bubble gum, and you hope it don't fall apart while you're doing some fast talking to this man. And your shoelace just busted, and you open a big cut on your cheek trying to even out your sideburns, and your daughter's gone out with a convict, and your wife just confessed she gave you last $60 as a deposit on an airplane hanger. Is that what's troubling you, friend?
Lift your head up high and take a walk in it.
Hey there, cousin. You say you can't pull your car out of the mud and you're in the middle of nowhere and it's pouring rain and you can't get the top back up and your paycheck's all blurred and your foot went right through the gas and your girl's screaming bloody murder. She's scared of the dark and a stroke of lightning splits your motor in half and your suit's shrinking up fast and you start up the windy road on foot and 60 yards of barbed wire hits you right smack in a push. And your boat falls down in the mud and a wild animal comes over and runs away with your shoes. And your car blows up suddenly and your windshield wiper ends up in your mouth and you can't move and the mud's rising up to your nostrils and you're sinking fast and you don't hear your girl screaming anymore. Is that what's on your mind, cousin?
Well, lift your head up high and take a walk in the sun with a dignity and stick to it, and you show the world, you show the world to get off. You'll never give up, never give up, never give up that ship.
And now, this is the old philosopher saying, so long, folks.
There. So much for Sousa marches and pep talks. So much for Panglossian cheerfulness. But how else do we respond to the absurdity? Sometimes, you know, I get the feeling that Evening Under Lamplight is like that track, and I am playing an even more absurd version of the old philosopher, just in a different key. Well, we can talk ourselves out of the darkness, give ourselves a little talking to, such as Ray Davies so often gives himself. In this next song, we get even more absurdity. In the face of life's tragedies, all he can say is that life goes on and on and on. That's supposed to be the light that consoles us. Or is there also a dim light of some consolation in the thought that we don't really matter in the larger scheme of things? There's no use running around looking scared. Life could get you when you're unaware. One day it's going to come, so you'd better accept it. Life will hit you when you least expect it. And one day when you are gone, you know that life will still go on. But no one will care if you've been good, bad, right or wrong. Life will still go on. But the real light, I think, comes from the absurdity of Le Chlemiel's futile attempts to give in to the darkness. He says, "My bank went broke and my well ran dry. It was almost enough to contemplate suicide. I turned on the gas, but I soon realized I hadn't settled my bill, so they cut off my supply." We can laugh at the irony there, even if he can't. Or does the light come just from the assurance that somehow the people are resilient and keep coming back, even if it's just coming back for more? As in these lines that will sound too familiar to my family and friends in New Jersey and New York. "Tornado, cyclone, and hurricane can batter the houses with the thunder and rain. Blizzards can blow, the waves hit the shore, but the people recover and come back for more. Somehow the people fight back, even if the future looks black. Life goes on and on and on." But now perhaps the deepest confirmation of the people's strength comes from the very performance itself, as the Kinks yet again blend their rock music with the communal sing-alongs they knew around the piano in the front room when they grew up. The song ends up to be a kind of thing we'd sing together by the fireside in winter, defying the darkness. Here, listen to what I mean.
My bank went broke and my well ran dry. It was almost enough to contemplate suicide. I turned on the gas, but then I soon realized I hadn't settled my bills, so they cut off my supply. No matter how I try, it seems I'm too young to die. Life goes on.
Yep, it happens every day. Just put on that deadpan, naive voice. Live for the moment, however you can manage it. But this song is not meant to be a philosophical, much less a theological, examination of how to handle the darkness of life. It's just a defiant attempt to light one little candle of cheerfulness, even desperate cheerfulness. And in its way, an act of kindness in our pain. And this focuses us on cheerfulness and kindness, and it's something I want to look at next. First, let's listen to Catherine Grody reading her piece called Small Acts of Kindness, an account of a little candlelight in the dark scramble of New York life.
Small Acts of Kindness. I had an unusual interaction at my corner the other afternoon, and it continues to haunt me as I ponder its many ramifications. I live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and I was in a hurry to make an appointment for parents of kids who were trying to live through the preparations of a bar mitzvah. And I fast walked to the corner, looked to my immediate left, and waved my arm at a coming yellow cab, which stopped in front of me. As I opened the door, I felt a rather distinct jab on my right shoulder, and I saw a woman looking like a version of myself, slightly harassed, middle-aged, creatively attired, to put it nicely, and profoundly irate. Did you not see me standing across the street for a goddamn hour with my goddamn grocery bags like a frigging pack mule frantically waving at every passing cab, she shrieked. Now, on most occasions in this city when I have a hostile encounter, I become chameleon-like in my response. Though I'm poor at expressing rage in any overt way on my own, if some stranger shouts at me or my kinder, I can easily out-scream them back. Maybe because I was on my way for a meeting with a rabbi, maybe because I had actually gotten more than 4 hours sleep the night before, and maybe because a pet peeve is taxi stealers, or maybe because of a combination of all of the above, I did not shout back in kind. Instead, I spoke from my most sincere heart and said, I am so sorry. I didn't look to my right, so I absolutely did not see you. I hate it when people do that to me. Please forgive me, and by all means take the taxi. And I opened the door for her. She looked at me with great chagrin and said, I am so embarrassed. Would you like to share the cab? It turned out that we were both going in the same direction, and I said I would love that. On the ride, we spoke of the crazy expense of taxis and the craziness of taxi drivers and about how you should always wear seat belts, even though it's a drag to dig them out of the back seats. When our short shared ride was over, I gave her half the fare, said thank you, and we wished each other well. I walked into my meeting feeling an unusual lightness of being, though I wasn't quite sure why. At the bar mitzvah meeting, the rabbi ended up trying to discuss a part of Deuteronomy that talked about godlike behavior, and what did that mean to the assembled adolescents and their parents. Much to my son's total chagrin, I raised my hand, not unlike the wave at the taxi, and said, "I just had a godlike experience." And I told the story about the angry woman and the shared taxi, because I realized that I had been the best possible human self I could have been at that moment instead of the worst, and that did make me feel godlike. It wasn't being able to move mountains or part seas or save populations. For me, the stunning aspect of that afternoon was how profound I had felt just being decent to a stranger and making the best of a typically stress-ridden moment. Being able to be my best self in challenging circumstances made me feel godlike, and full of so many possibilities that I became beatific and felt a sureness about the enormous power and possibilities of small acts of kindness to change the world. My family, in particular the bar mitzvah boy, have gotten very tired of hearing this tale. I tell it often because I haven't directly experienced anything like it since. I have lost my temper at rude cashiers in the marketplace, with people on the sidewalk when they have smashed into me and not managed an excuse me, screamed at my dogs and been impatient with my children. But the memory of my best self on a winter day on a New York City corner with a stranger keeps coming back to remind me of how good it feels to simply be good, and inspires me to remember the day I felt godlike and to see if it is possible to experience that feeling more than once in a lifetime.
The Kinks' song Life Goes On was, as we said, a kind of cheerful sing-along, and Catherine Grody gives us an enlightening anecdote. But let's go on to a more sustained treatment of what we are to do in the midst of the darkness, failure, and confusion we face each day. It's here that we move to our reading from Robert Louis Stevenson, and it's appropriate for several reasons that we should look at his essay, A Christmas Sermon. He called it a sermon, I'm pretty sure, partly to annoy his atheist friends, but also, quite seriously, to offer an alternative to the dour, self-righteous moralism he fought against all his life. This essay formed the final installment of a series of essays Stevenson wrote for an American magazine, and it's good that it features here in the final installment of this series of Evening Under Lamplight. You've indulged my Stevenson obsessions this far. Indulge me a little further, and let me give you a bit of background, not just because your host here on Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, not just because I am a little pedantic about these essays of Stevenson's, but also because I hope you will find the story behind the essays interesting in itself. In 1887, Stevenson and his family sailed from England to New York, aiming to find a suitable place to spend the winter where Stevenson would be free from the frequent hemorrhaging that had plagued him even in the south of England. He had been a cult figure in the New York avant-garde for several years, but after the publication of Treasure Island, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Kidnapped, and A Child's Garden of Verses, he was now a celebrity, and he was welcomed in New York by crowds of journalists wanting interviews and fans wanting autographs. Oh yes, and also by publishers who wanted to offer him fantastic sums to produce essays for them. The New York World offered him $10,000 a year to write a weekly column for the newspaper. The prestigious Scribner's magazine offered him $3,500 for a series of 12 monthly essays. In sterling, these prices were £2,000 and £700 a year, a fortune for someone who only a few years before would have been happy to earn even just £250 a year. Stevenson was embarrassed by the $10,000 offer, and certainly he had no wish to tie himself down to a weekly deadline. But he took up the monthly magazine commission. This was September. The first essay would appear in January 1888. Isolated in what was little more than a cabin in upstate New York, Stevenson determined to get a head start and wrote several essays fairly quickly. But as usual, he became diverted by other projects, notably his new novel, The Master of Ballantrae, and by a very bitter quarrel with one of his best friends back in England. And when he left the Adirondacks in April, preparing for a cruise into the South Pacific, he still had the three final essays to write. He secluded himself in a hotel in Manasquan, New Jersey, and when not enjoying the warm spring weather outside, finished his work for Scribner's. Two of the essays are really just a series of what he called random memories. But the final essay, his Christmas sermon, was a much more substantial piece. In fact, it became one of his most popular essays,